when he fell out of a nest, or so says Martin Schnurr, who rescued him. He nursed the bird back to health, and when it kept hanging around, fed it cold coffee and bits of donuts on his porch in Hanover. But when the crow chased a neighbor's kids, the authorities got called. Turns out, crows are a federally regulated migratory species, and Mr. Schnurr doesn't have the state and federal license to keep him. He escaped from the place where the Department of Environmental Services was holding him, Schnurr said proudly. Found his way back 10 whole miles. As the crow flies, of course, I say. So what can I do for you, Mr. Schnurr? The DES is going to come after him again. I want a restraining order, Schnurr says. I'm willing to go to the Supreme Court if I have to. The likelihood of this case going to Washington is somewhere between nil and nevermore. But before I can explain this, the door to the office bursts open, and there's Delia, frantic and crying. My inside sees. I'm imagining the very worst. I'm thinking of Sophie. Without even a glance at the client, I pull Delia into the hall and try to shake the facts out of her. My father's been arrested, she says. You have to go, Eric. You have to. I have no idea what Andrew might have done, and I do not ask. She believes I can fix this. And like always, that's enough to make me think I can. I'll take care of it, I say, when what I really mean is I'll take care of you. We didn't play inside my house. I made sure to get up early enough so that I was always the one knocking on Delia's door, or Fitz's. On the occasions that we settled at my place, I did my best to keep everyone outside, under the backyard deck or beneath the sloping saltbox roof of our garage, and that's how I managed to keep my secret until I was 9. That was the winter Fitz started to play league hockey, which left Delia and me alone in the afternoons. She was a latchkey kid. Her father was always working at the senior center. Something that never bothered her until we happened to see a TV movie about a twin who died and had his ring finger sent to his brother in a velvet box. After that, Delia didn't like being by herself. She started to come up with reasons to hang out at her house after school, something I was more than happy to do, if only to get out of my own. I always stopped off at home first, though. I had 100 ready excuses. I wanted to drop off my backpack. I had to grab a warmer sweatshirt. I needed my mother to sign a report card. Afterward, I would head next door. One day, as usual, Dee and I split up at the fork in the sidewalk that divided my driveway from hers. See you in a few, she said. My house was quiet, which wasn't a good sign. I wandered through it, calling for my mother, until I found her passed out on the kitchen floor. She was sprawled on her side this time, and there was a puddle of vomit under her cheek. When she blinked, the insides of her eyes were the color of cut rubies. I picked up the bottle and poured the bourbon down the sink drain. I rolled my mother out of the way so I could clean up her mess with paper towels. Then I got behind her and braced myself hard, trying to lever her weight so I could drag her to the living room couch. What can I do? It wasn't until I heard Delia's quiet voice that I realized she'd been standing in the kitchen for a while. When she spoke, she couldn't meet my eyes, and that was a good thing. She helped me get my mother to the couch, onto her side, where if she got sick again, she wouldn't choke. I turned on the TV, a soap I knew she liked. Eric, baby, would you get me? My mother slurred. But she didn't finish her sentence before she passed out again. When I looked around, Delia was gone. Well, it didn't surprise me. It was, in fact, the reason I'd kept the secret from my two best friends. Once they saw the truth, I was sure they'd turn tail and run. I walked back to the kitchen, each foot a lead weight. Delia stood there, holding a sponge and staring down at the linoleum. "Will carpet cleaner work even if it's not used on carpet?" she asked. "You should go," I told her. I looked down at the floor and pretended to be fascinated with the little blue dot pattern. Delia came closer to me, seeing the freak I truly was. With one finger, she traced an X over her chest. "I won't tell." One traitor tear slicked its way down my cheek. I scrubbed it away with a fist. "You should go," I repeated. The last thing in the world that I wanted. "Okay," Delia agreed. But she didn't leave. The Wexton Police Station is like 100 other small-town law enforcement agencies. A squat cement building with a flagpole planted out front like a giant tulip stalk. A dispatcher so infrequently bothered that she keeps a portable TV at her desk. A nursery school class mural spread along the wall, thanking the chief for keeping everyone safe. I walk inside and ask to speak to Andrew Hopkins. I tell the dispatcher, I'm his attorney. A door buzzes and a sergeant comes into the hallway. "He's back here," the officer says, leading me through the pretzeled hallways into the booking room. I ask to see the warrant for Andrew's arrest, pretending, like any defense attorney, to know far more than I actually do at this minute. When I scan the paper, I have to do my best to keep a straight face. Kidnapping? Indicting Andrew Hopkins for kidnapping is like charging Mother Teresa with heresy. As far as I know, he's never even gotten a traffic ticket, much less been implicated in criminal behavior. He's been a model father, attentive, devoted, the parent I would have killed to have when I was growing up. No wonder Delia's so rattled. To have your father accused of living a secret life when in fact he's been about as public a figure as humanly possible, well, it's insane. There are two lockups in Wexton, used mostly for DUIs who need to sleep off a bender. I've been in the one on the left myself. Andrew sits on the steel bench in the other. When he sees me, he gets to his feet. Until this moment, I haven't really considered him to be an old man. But Andrew is almost 60 and looks every year of it in the shallow gray light of the holding cell. His hands curl around the bars. "Where's Delia?" "She's fine. She's the one who came to get me." I take a step forward and angle my shoulder, blocking our conversation until the sergeant leaves the room. "Listen, Andrew, you have nothing to worry about. Obviously, this is a case of mistaken identity. We'll contest it, set everything straight, and then maybe even get you some money for emotional damages." "Now, it's not a mistake," he says softly. I stare at him, speechless. He starts to repeat his confession, but I stop him before I have to hear it again. "Don't tell me," I interrupt. "Don't say anything else, all right?" Part of me has shifted into automatic defense attorney mode. If your client confesses, and they almost always want to, you put in earplugs and go about doing your job. Whatever the vice, felony or misdemeanor, murder or, Jesus Christ, kidnapping, you can still find a way to make a jury see the shades of gray involved. But part of me is not an attorney, just Delia's fiancé. A man who needs to hear the truth so he can tell it to her. What kind of person steals a child? What would I do to the son of a bitch who took Sophie? I look down at the arrest warrant again. Bethany Matthews. I read out loud. That used to be her name. He doesn't have to explain the rest. I know in that instant that we're talking about Delia, that she is the little girl who was stolen a lifetime ago. I know better than most people that a criminal isn't always a thug in a black leather jacket with a big brand on his forehead to warn us away. Criminals sit next to us on the bus. They pack our groceries and cash our paychecks for us and teach our children. They look no different from you or me, and that's why they get away with it. The lawyer in me urges caution, remembers that there are mitigating circumstances I don't yet know. The rest of me wonders if Delia cried when he took her, if she was scared, if her mother spent years searching for her, if she still is. Eric, listen. You'll be arraigned tomorrow in New Hampshire on the fugitive charges, I interrupt. But you've been indicted by an Arizona grand jury. We'll have to go there to enter a plea. Eric. Andrew. I turn my back on him. I can't. I just can't right now. I'm about to exit the lockup, but at the last moment, I walk back toward the cell. Is she yours? Of course she's mine. Of course? I snap. For God's sake, Andrew, I just found out that you're a kidnapper. I have to tell Delia you're a kidnapper. I don't exactly think it's an unreasonable question. I take a deep breath. How old was she? 4. And in 28 years, you never told her? She loves me. Andrew looks down at the floor. Would you risk losing that? Without answering, I turn and walk away.
This ends Disc 1. Vanishing Acts, Disc 2.
When I was 11, I realized that Delia Hopkins was female. She wasn't like ordinary girls. She didn't have the dreamy, loopy handwriting that reminded us of soap bubbles lined up in a row. She didn't giggle behind her hand in a way that made us wonder what we'd done wrong. She didn't come to school with neat braids twisted like French crullers. Instead, she spoke to frogs. She could make a slap shot from the blue line. She was the first one to cut her palm with Fitz's Swiss Army knife when we three made a blood vow, and she didn't even flinch. The summer after 5th grade, everything changed. Without even trying, I smelled Delia's hair when she sat near me. I noticed how her brown summer skin stretched tight over the muscles of her shoulders. I watched her tilt her face to the sun and felt an answer in my own body. I kept these thoughts a secret through the first half of 6th grade until Valentine's Day. It was the first time in school that we weren't forced to bring in a card for everyone in the class, including the kid who picked his nose, and the missing link, who had so much hair on her arms and back you could practically braid it. Girls flitted around the cafeteria like butterflies, alighting long enough to plant kisses on the bright cheeks of boys they liked. When it happened, you'd pretend to be disgusted, but there would be a coal burning inside you. Fitz got a card from Abigail Lewis, who had just gotten glow-in-the-dark braces and, it was rumored, invited select boys into the custodian's closet to watch them light up. In my own back pocket was a folded pink heart that I'd glued to a square of red construction paper. "When I'm with you, bells go off in my head," I had written, and then added, "like a moving truck that's backing up." I was going to give it to Delia, but 1,000 times that day, the moment hadn't been right. Fitz was with us, or she was too busy rummaging in her locker, or the teacher came by before I could pass it across the aisle. I slipped it out of my pocket just in time to have Fitz grab it out of my hand. You got a card too, didn't you? He read it aloud, and he and Delia started to laugh. Angry, I snatched it back. I didn't get it from someone, you jerk. I'm giving it. And because Delia was still sort of laughing, I marched right past her and up to the first girl I saw, Itsy Fisher, carrying a hot lunch tray. Here, I said, and I shoved the card between her napkin and her slab of pizza. There was absolutely nothing special about Itsy Fisher. She had long, frizzy hair that nearly touched her behind, and she wore gold-rimmed glasses that sometimes caught the light in class and made little reflections dance on the blackboard. I had barely said three words to her all year. Itsy Fisher? Delia accused when I sat back down. You like her? And then she got up and ran out of the cafeteria. Groaning, I flopped my head down on my arms. I didn't make that card for Itsy. It was for Delia. Delia? Fitz said. You wouldn't understand. Fitz stared right at me. What makes you think that? In the thousands of times I have replayed this moment over the years, I realized that what happened next could have gone a different way. That had Fitz been less of a best friend, or more competitive, or even more honest with himself, my life might have turned out very different. But instead, he asked me for a dollar. Why? Because she's pissed at you, he said, as I fished into my lunch money. And I can fix that. He took a Sharpie from his binder and wrote something across George Washington's face. Then he creased the bill the long way. He brought up the bottom edge and then the halves, turned it over, and tucked in both sides. A few more maneuvers, and then he handed me a dollar folded into the shape of a heart. When I found Delia, she was sitting underneath the water fountain near the gym. I handed her Fitz's heart. I watched her open it, read the message along with her. If all I could ever have is you, I'd be a billionaire. Itsy might get jealous, Delia said. Itsy and I broke up. She burst out laughing. That's the shortest relationship in history. I glanced over at her. You're not still mad at me, are you? That depends. Did you write this? Yes. I lied. Can I keep the dollar? I blinked. I guess. Then no, she said. I'm not mad. I waited for years to see Delia spend that dollar on something. Every time she pulled out money to buy candy or ice cream or a Coke, I'd scan it for Fitz's words. But as far as I know, she never spent it. As far as I know, she has it still. When I go into Andrew's house, it's quiet. I call for Delia, but there's no answer. Wandering around, I check the bathroom and the living room and the kitchen, and then I hear noise coming from upstairs. The door to Sophie's room is closed. When I open it, she's on the floor playing with the crime scene dollhouse. Delia and I got to calling it that when Sophie would leave the rooms with the contents overturned, a Barbie or two spread-eagled on the floor of the kitchen or bathroom. Daddy, she says, did you bring Grandpa home? I'm working on it, I tell her, ruffling her hair. Where's Mommy? Out back with Greta. Sophie holds a Ken doll up to the front door. Open up! It's the police, she says. When I look at Sophie, I see Delia. Not just in the physical features. Delia's dark hair and rosy cheeks are duplicated in our daughter, but their expressions are identical. Like how a smile unfurls across both their faces. A sail caught in a rip of wind. And the habit they have of separating the food on their plates into similar colors. Or the way, when they look at me, I so badly want to be who they see. I watched Sophie for another moment, thinking about what I would do if someone took her away from me, how I'd upend the earth to find her. And then I hesitate and wonder what might make me be the one to run away with her in tow. Downstairs, I find Delia, deep in thought on the outside deck. Her legs are propped up on Greta, a lightly snoring ottoman. When she sees me, she startles. "Did you?" "I can't get him out until the arraignment tomorrow." "He has to spend the night at the police station?" I weigh the cost of admitting that, actually, her father will spend the night in the Grafton County Jail, and decide against it. "First thing in the morning, we can go to the courthouse." She glances up at me. "But they'll let him go, won't they? They're looking for someone named Bethany Matthews. That's not me. That was never me. And I wasn't kidnapped. Don't you think I'd remember something like that?" Taking a deep breath, I ask, "Do you remember your mother dying?" "Eric, I was practically a baby. Do you remember it?" She shakes her head. "Your father told you your mother was dead, Delia," I say bluntly. "And then he brought you to New Hampshire." Her chin comes up. "You're lying." "No, Dee. He was." Just then, Fitz bursts onto the deck. "Why aren't you answering the phone? I've been trying to get in touch with you for an hour." "I've been a little busy trying to get my father out of police custody." "You found out," Fitz says, his jaw dropping, "about the kidnapping." "How the hell do you know about it?" I ask. Fitz sits down across from Delia. "That's why I've been trying to call you. You remember how we were talking about past lives the other day? Well, I started to think about how people reinvent themselves all the time, and that maybe there was a more logical explanation to the whole lemon tree memory than the fact that you used to be a citrus farmer in 18th century Tuscany. So I jumped online and Googled your name. Come on inside, I'll show you." We follow Fitz to Delia's computer, buried under topographical maps of New Hampshire and Vermont and catalogs from canine supply companies. Fitz starts to type, and a minute later, a screen is filled with stripes of search results. The first few links are Gazette stories about Delia and Greta making a missing person rescue. But Fitz clicks on a different link, and a page from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch fills the screen. "Cordelia Lynn Hopkins," it reads, "daughter of Margaret Ketchum Hopkins and the late Andrew Hopkins, was born in Maryland Heights on March 16th, 1973. "That's my birthday," Delia says. "In Clarkton, and died March 8th, 1977, at the age of 4, as a result of complications from an automobile accident that also claimed the life of her father. Survivors include her mother, her grandparents, Joe and Alita Ketchum, and a brother, Lloyd. Funeral services will be conducted at 11 a.m. on Saturday at the Malden Baptist Church, with Reverend Thomas Monroe officiating. Interment will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery in Malden." She had the same name, the same birthday. Her father died in the same car crash. And the accident happened the same year that you showed up with your father in Wexton. "Type in Bethany Matthews," I tell Fitz. The screen glows green with a new list of articles, all from the Arizona Republic. "Child abducted during custody visit. Mother vows to find missing daughter. No new leads in Scottsdale kidnapping case." Fitz clicks on one link. June 20th, 1977. "Investigators continue to search for clues in the disappearance of Bethany Matthews, 4, of Scottsdale, who was last seen in the company of her father, Charles Matthews, 33, during a routine custody visit. Police in Albuquerque, acting on a tip, raided a hotel room that had been paid for with Mr. Matthews' credit card, but turned up no positive results. Meanwhile, the girl's mother, Elise Matthews, has not given up hope that her daughter will be found and returned safely. "There is nothing in this world," Mrs. Matthews vowed yesterday at a televised press conference, "that can keep me away from her." Mr. and Mrs. Matthews divorced in March and shared custody. Matthews was last seen picking up his daughter from the home of his ex-wife at 9 a.m. on Saturday, where he indicated that he would return before 6 p.m. on Sunday. When he didn't bring Bethany back, and Vasquez was unable to reach him via telephone, she involved the police. An initial search of Matthews' apartment suggested that the subject had permanently vacated the premises. Volunteers who would like to contribute time or materials to the search effort should report to the Saguaro High School Gymnasium. Any tips regarding the whereabouts of Bethany Matthews or Charles Matthews should be directed to the Scottsdale Police at 555-3333. Delia puts her hand over Fitz's, where it rests on the mouse. She clicks a single word at the end of the article. Photo. Twin headshots fill the computer screen. One of a little girl who looks frighteningly like Sophie. The other of a younger, grinning Andrew Hopkins. A minute later, she runs out the door and into the woods, Greta bounding off at her heels. We both know enough to let her go. "This is all my fault," Fitz says. "I think Andrew might be a little more to blame." He shakes his head. "I didn't know her name, her real name. After I saw the obituary on Cordelia Hopkins, I started thinking of who might steal an identity and why. Delia mentioned some weird memory about a lemon tree, so I narrowed down my search by figuring out where they'd grow." Fitz starts counting off in his fingers. "Florida, Southern California, Arizona. Only one of them had a well-publicized kidnapping case in 1977. I called the number in the article for the Scottsdale Police and asked about Bethany Matthews. It took a while to find someone who knew what I was talking about. All of the officers who'd worked on the case had retired. They asked me where I was calling from."
"And you told them?" Fitz grimaces. "I had to say I was a journalist, didn't I? The thing is, Eric, I never told them Delia's new name."
He gets up from the chair and faces the window, scanning the woods as if he might be able to see her. "My guess is that someone from Scottsdale heard the words New Hampshire Gazette, did a little digging on the internet. Andrew's a town councilman. You know how many times his picture's been in the paper? Not to mention Delia's."
"He hid in plain sight," I murmur.
It seems remarkably fast for a law enforcement agency to have connected the dots, and yet I know that it's an illusion. A warrant for Andrew's arrest had been sworn out for nearly 30 years. The police just didn't know where he was so they could serve it. Fitz turns away, his hands in his pockets.
"You have to go find her."
"You go. You're the one who brought in the cops."
"I know," Fitz admits. "But I'm not the one she wants."
By the time the end of sixth grade rolled around, boys had mustered up the nerve to ask girls out. This meant absolutely nothing except that the duo would sit next to each other at lunch in the cafeteria and occasionally talk on the phone. By this criteria, Delia and I were practically married. We spent far more time together than any couple in the Wexton Middle School. That is, until Fitz officially asked Delia to go out with him. I knew it meant nothing. Rumors about who liked whom flew around like gypsy moths in August. But all the same, I spent too much time wishing that I was Fitz. Holding on to Delia's hand when we balanced on the railroad tracks, or lying next to her on the damp grass when we tried to look at the solar eclipse through a pinhole in a shoebox.
After a while, Fitz stopped calling me, and then Delia. And I tried to convince myself that I'd never needed either of them. I went stag to the end of school dance. I was listening to the boasts of Donnie DeMario, a 12-year-old who had a mustache and a pack of bootleg cigarettes, when Delia appeared, crying. "Fitz broke up with me," she said. I couldn't imagine why. Later, he told me the truth. "I'd rather have both of you," he said in that easy way of his, "than just one." But at that moment, Fitz was absent, and Delia was so close that the hair on my arms was reaching toward the heat of her. "I guess I could go out with you," I said. "You guess you could go out with me?" she repeated. "Gee, thanks for making the sacrifice. Don't do me any favors." I knew her well enough to understand that when Delia pushed you away, it was her way of making sure she didn't get shoved first. I grabbed her arm before she could run away. "I would very much like to go out with you," I said more carefully. "Is that better?" "Maybe." "So, what do we do?" I asked. She chewed her bottom lip. "We could dance, if you want." I'd never danced with a girl before. And even though Delia and I had grown up skinny dipping in ponds and sleeping so close in a pitch tent that we had to share each other's air, it felt unreasonably new. My hands skimmed over Delia's spine to settle on her hips. She smelled like peaches, and beneath her knit dress, I could feel the thin elastic of her underwear. She talked for both of us. She talked about how on the phone one night, Fitz had asked her out, and how she didn't know whether to say yes or no, and yes had just slipped out. She talked about how she fully intended to get back her Dwight Evans baseball card, which she had given to Fitz as a way of saying she really liked him. When the song ended, Delia didn't pull away. She stayed there, maybe even moved a tiny bit closer. "You want to keep talking?" I asked. "No," she said, smiling into my eyes. "I think I'm done." When I find her, she is 10 feet above my head, in the scarred elbow of an oak tree. Greta sits at the bottom whining. "Hey," I say, pushing aside some of the smaller branches and leaves. "You okay?" Above me, the stars are coming out, a bright-eyed audience. "What if this is all my fault?" Delia asks. "How could it be?" I reply. "You don't even remember it happening." "Maybe I do, and I blocked it out. Maybe my father hid that from me, too." I hesitate. I'm sure he's got an explanation for what happened. Delia drops down from the tree, landing like a cat beside me. "Then why didn't he give it to me?" she says, her voice striped with scars. "He had 28 years. Don't you think that's long enough to mention, maybe, that Delia Hopkins is a dead girl from Missouri? You know, Delia, honey, can you pass the Cheerios? And did I ever tell you that when you were 4, I stole you away from your mother?" Suddenly, Delia's face goes white. "Eric," she asks, "do you think I still have a mother?" "I don't know," I admit. "We'll find out once we get to Arizona." "Arizona?" "After your father is arraigned on fugitive charges in New Hampshire, he'll be extradited to Arizona. That's where the crime allegedly occurred. If it goes to trial, you'll probably be called as a witness." She seems horrified by this.
"What if I don't want to be one?"
"You may not have that choice," I admit. She takes a step closer to me, and I fold my arms around her.
What if I wasn't meant to grow up here? Like this, she says, her voice muffled against my shirt. What if there was a different cosmic plan for Bethany Matthews? What if there was a different cosmic plan for Delia Hopkins, one that got ruined because of a car crash? I search my mind frantically for the right thing to say. I try to think of Fitz, of what he would tell me to tell her.
You could have been Bethany Matthews, Delia Hopkins, Cleopatra. It wouldn't matter. And if you'd grown up with 1,000 lemon trees in the middle of the desert, with a cactus instead of a Christmas tree, and a pet armadillo, well then, I would have gone to law school at Arizona State, I guess. I would have defended illegal aliens crossing the border. But we still would have wound up together, Dee. No matter what kind of life I had, you'd be at the end of it. She smiles, just a little. I'm pretty sure I was never Cleopatra. I drop a kiss on her forehead. Well, I reply, that's a start. We were 15 and drunk, and in the bell tower of Baker Library at Dartmouth, watching a meteor shower that the newscaster said would only be this vivid once in our lifetimes, although that was hard to believe, feeling as we did that we would live forever. We played games to pass the time, I Spy, and 20 questions. Anyone who didn't get the answer had to chug. By the time our corner of the world turned to face the meteor shower, Fitz was snoring with his mouth open, and Delia was having trouble zipping up her sweatshirt. Here, I said, and I did it for her, just as a fireball chased the moon across the sky. Delia watched the midnight show, and I watched her. Sometimes she smiled or laughed out loud. Mostly her mouth just made a wondrous O as the night changed before her eyes. When some of the activity died down, I leaned forward until our lips touched. She drew back immediately, stared hard at me. Then she wrapped her arms around my neck and kissed me back. I remember that we didn't really know what we were doing, that I felt two sizes too big for my skin, that my heart was beating so hard it moved the denim of my shirt. I remember that for one moment, I believed I was hitchhiking on one of those comets, falling so fast that I'd surely burn away before I ever hit the ground. At 9 o'clock the next morning, Delia and I take a seat close to the defense table at the Wexton District Court. It's a rotating habitat for public defenders and hired guns like myself, a new one warming the chair each time the judge calls for a new case. Arraignments are a rubber stamp process. The prosecutor, rifling through a big box of files as defendant after defendant is brought in. We watch a woman get arraigned for stealing a toaster oven from Kmart. A man brought in for violating a restraining order. A third defendant, one I recognize as a hot dog stand vendor in town, has been arrested for the felonious sexual assault of a minor. It reminds me that there are people in this world who have done worse things than Andrew Hopkins. Do you know the prosecutor? Delia whispers. Ned Floritz was the leader of my AA meeting yesterday, but recovering alcoholics are always in the business of keeping one another's secrets. I've seen him around, I say. When our case is called, Andrew is brought in wearing a bright orange jumpsuit that says Grafton County Department of Corrections on the back. His hands and legs are shackled. Beside me, Delia gasps. Her father's incarceration is, after all, still new to her. I stand up and button my jacket, carry my briefcase down to the defense table. Andrew's eyes roam the courtroom. Delia! He yells out, and she stands up. Sir, the bailiff says, please face front. I can feel sweat breaking out on my forehead. I've been in court before, but not for a case of this magnitude. Not for a case where I have a personal stake in the outcome. Beside me, Andrew touches my arm. Make them take the chains off. I don't want her to see me like this. It's inmate policy in the courtroom, I answer. I can't do anything about it. The judge is a woman relatively new to the bench. She comes from a public defender's background, which is a plus for Andrew, but she's also the mother of three small children. I have before me a complaint alleging that you are a fugitive from justice with kidnapping contrary to the laws of Arizona. I see that you have an attorney with you, so I'll address my remarks to him. You have two options today. One is to waive extradition and go to Arizona to meet the charge. The other option is to contest extradition and require the state to seek a governor's warrant. My client chooses to waive extradition, Your Honor, I say. He's looking forward to dealing with this charge quickly. The judge nods. Then bail won't be an issue. I assume you're going to allow us to incarcerate Mr. Hopkins until he can be transferred to Arizona. Actually, Judge, we'd like bail to be set, I say. The prosecutor is out of his seat like a shot. Absolutely not, Your Honor. The judge turns toward him. Mr. Flores, is there something you'd like to add? Your Honor, the two primary considerations for bail are the safety of the community and risk of flight. The defendant is just about the biggest flight risk you could ask for. Look at what already happened. Allegedly happened, I interject. Mr. Hopkins is a valuable member of the Wexton community. He has served for 5 years as a town councilman. He's almost single-handedly responsible for the creation of the current senior center, and he has been nothing less than an exemplary parent and grandparent. This isn't a man who's a menace to society, Your Honor. I urge the court to consider the admirable citizen he's been before rushing to any hasty judgment. Too late, I realize what I've done wrong. You never, never ever infer that a judge might be hasty in his or her decision-making. It's like pointing out to a wolf that it has bad breath while it's considering ripping out your carotid. The judge looks coolly at me. I believe that I have more than adequate information to make a legitimate ruling here, swift though it may be, counselor. I'm setting a $1 million cash-only bail. She bangs her gavel. Next case. The bailiffs haul Andrew out of the courtroom before he even has a chance to ask me what happens next. The seniors erupt in a slow-motion flurry of activity, crying foul and then being shuffled by another bailiff into the hallway. The prosecutor gets up from his seat and walks toward me. Eric, he says, you sure you're ready to get involved in something like this? He isn't questioning my legal abilities, but my tolerance for stress. Although he's been dry for 20 years, I'm a neophyte. I give him a tight smile. I've got it under control. I lie. Recovering alcoholics are good at that, too. I relinquish my table to a public defender who's getting ready for the next arraignment. I'm not looking forward to Delia's disappointment, now that she knows Andrew will have to stay overnight in jail again, that I've already failed. Resigned, I turn to the spot where we were sitting, but she's disappeared. 6 years ago, I drove my car off the road while I was trying to open a bottle of Stoli and steer with my knees. By some miracle, the only casualty was a sugar maple. I walked to a bar where I had to consume a few drinks before I felt calm enough to call Delia and tell her what had happened. The next week,
I found myself waking up in places I had no recollection of going to. The living room of a fraternity on the Dartmouth campus. The kitchen of a Chinese restaurant. The cement divider of the Wilder Dam. It was after one of these benders that I found myself in the backyard at Delia and Andrew's house, asleep in their hammock. What woke me was the sound of crying. Delia was sitting on the ground beside me, shredding pieces of grass with her hands. "I'm pregnant," she said. My head was swimming underwater. My tongue was as thick as a mossy field, but immediately I thought, she's mine now. I stumbled out of the hammock and onto one knee. I tugged the ponytail elastic out of Delia's hair and doubled it up, then reached for her hand. "Delia Hopkins," I said, "will you marry me?" I slid the makeshift ring onto her finger and turned up the wattage on my smile. When she didn't answer, just curled up her knees and buried her head against them, I began to feel the butterfly beat of panic in the pit of my stomach. "Delia?" I said, swallowing. "Is it the baby? Do you want to get rid of it?" The thought of a part of me taking root in her was miraculous to me, like finding an orchid growing in the cracks of a broken tenement sidewalk. But I was willing to give that up in return for Delia. I would do anything for her. When she looked at me, there was nothing in her eyes, as if she'd pulled free from her life the strand that was me. "I want the baby, Eric," she said. "But I don't want you." Delia had complained about my drinking before, but since she hardly drank herself, it seemed impossible for her to be able to know what exactly constituted too much. She claimed she didn't like the smell of alcohol, but I thought it was loss of control she couldn't handle. And that seemed to be her hang-up, not mine. Sometimes she got angry enough to take a real stand, but it was a vicious cycle. Every time she swore she'd leave me, it would only send me spiraling down into a bottle, and eventually she'd come help me crawl back out to consciousness, swearing up one side and down another that it would never happen again, when we both knew that it would. This time, though, she wasn't leaving on her own behalf, but someone else's. For a long time after she walked away, I sat on the lawn in her backyard, balancing the truth between my shoulders like Atlas's weight. When I finally headed home, I looked up the information for Alcoholics Anonymous and went to a meeting that night. It took me some time, but eventually I realized why Delia said no to my proposal. I had asked her to spend the wrong life with me. But at any moment, a person might start over from scratch. I would like to take the time to find Delia, but right now I can't. I make one phone call to the prosecutors in Arizona. The canned voice I reach informs me that the Maricopa County Attorney's office hours are from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I glance at my watch and realize that in Arizona, it's only 7 in the morning. I leave a message informing whoever needs to know that I'm representing Andrew Hopkins, that he has waived extradition here in New Hampshire District Court in return, we hope, for a speedy transport. Then I head downstairs to the sheriff's office, where Andrew is temporarily occupying a 6-foot square space. "I need to see Delia," he says. "That's not an option right now. You don't understand. You know, Andrew, as the parent of a 4-year-old, I honestly don't." This brings back yesterday's conversation and his confession. Andrew wisely changes the subject. "When do we leave for Arizona?" "It's their call. It could be tomorrow, it could be a month from now. And in the meantime?" "You get luxurious accommodations provided by the state of New Hampshire. And you get to meet with me, so we can figure out what we're going to do in Phoenix. Right now, I have no idea what evidence the prosecution has. Until I can put together the pieces, we'll just enter a not guilty plea and figure out the rest later.
But,
Andrew says, what if I want to plead guilty? In the history of my career, I have only met one defendant who didn't at least want to tell his side of the story. The man was 70 and had served 30 years in the state penitentiary. He held up a bank 15 minutes after his release, then explained to the teller that he'd be waiting out front on the curb for the police. All he'd wanted was to get back to an environment he understood, which is what makes Andrew's comments even stranger. For all intents and purposes, a man who once resorted to crime in order to have a life with his daughter should want to continue to spend it in her company. Once you enter a guilty plea, Andrew, it's over. You can always switch your plea from not guilty to guilty, but you can't go the other way around. And after 28 years, their evidence has to be sketchy. Their witnesses might not even be alive anymore. There's a good chance you'll be acquitted. Andrew looks at me. Eric, are you my lawyer? I am completely unequipped to be Andrew's attorney. I don't have the experience or the wits or the confidence, but I think of Delia, begging, believing that someone who was once a failure might still be a candidate for a hero. Yes, I say. Then don't you have to do what I ask? I don't answer that. I knew what I was doing 28 years ago, Eric. And I know what I'm doing now. He exhales heavily. Plead guilty. I stare at him. Did you bother to think how this might affect Delia? Andrew looks over my shoulder at something for a long moment. That's all I ever think about, he replies. Once, when we were 17, Delia cheated on me. I was supposed to meet her at a bend in the Connecticut River where we liked to go swimming. There was a swatch of cattails and reeds that hid you from the eyes of anyone on the road should you feel like making out with your girlfriend. I rode my bike down there, a half hour late, and heard Delia talking to Fitz. I couldn't see them through the grasses, but they were arguing about the origin of the O. Henry bar. It's named after Hank Aaron, she insisted. That's what everyone used to say when he hit another home run. Wrong. It's the writer, Fitz said. No one names a candy bar after a writer. They're all baseball players. O. Henry, Baby Ruth. That was named after Grover Cleveland's daughter. I heard a shriek. Fitz, don't! Don't you dare! A splash, as he tossed her into the river and fell in himself. I pushed through the screen of reeds to jump in along with them, but when I had almost reached the bank, I saw Fitz and Delia in the water, wrapped around each other and kissing. I don't know who started it, but I do know that Delia was the one who stopped. She pushed Fitz away and ran out to grab her towel, then stood shivering 3 feet away from my hiding spot. Delia, Fitz said, coming out of the river too. Wait. I didn't want to stay and listen to what she had to say. I was afraid to hear it. So I retreated in silence and then ran back to my bike. I rode home in record time, and I spent the rest of the afternoon in my room with the lights off, lying on my bed, and pretending that I hadn't spotted what I had. Delia never confessed to kissing Fitz, and I didn't bring it up. In fact, I never mentioned it to anyone. But a witness is defined through what he sees, not what he says. And just because you keep something a secret doesn't mean it never happened, no matter how much you want that to be true. I find Delia watching a flock of kids alighting on a jungle gym. You know how I hate to swing? She says.
Yeah, I say, wondering where this is going.
Do you know why?
Delia broke her arm once on a swing set when she was 8. I always figured it had something to do with that, but when I tell her so, she shakes her head.
It's that moment when you've gone too high and the chains go slack for a half second, Delia says. I was always afraid I was going to fall.
And then you did, I point out.
My father promised he'd catch me if that happened, she says. And because I was a kid, I actually believed him. But he couldn't be there all the time, no matter what he'd said.
She watches a little girl hide under the long silver tongue of the sliding pond.
You didn't tell me he was in jail.
It's going to get worse before it gets better, Dee.
She pushes away from the fence. Can I go talk to him now?
No, I say gently. You can't. She is unraveling before me.
Eric, I don't know who I am, she says, her eyes filling with tears.
All I know is that I'm not the person I was yesterday. I don't know if I've got a mother somewhere. I don't know if I was being hurt in some way I don't even want to think about. I don't know why he thought that what he did would hurt me any less. Why would he lie to me? Unless he wasn't so sure I'd forgive him.
She shakes her head. I don't know if I can trust him now. I don't know if I ever will. Again. But I also don't. I don't know who else I'm supposed to ask for the answers.
Sweetheart. Nobody just steals a child, she interrupts. So what god-awful thing happened that I can't remember?
I settle my hands on her shoulders. I can feel everything inside her spinning like a top.
I can't tell you that yet, I say. But neither can your father. Legally, I'm the only one who's allowed to talk to him.
Delia lifts her face, fierce.
Then you go ask him what happened.
Although it's unseasonably warm for March, she's shivering. I take off my jacket and drape it over her.
I can't. I'm his attorney, I say. This is exactly why I think someone else should represent him, Delia asks. Someone who only knows my father because he's a name on a manila folder? Someone who could care less whether he gets convicted or acquitted because it's all just in a day's work?
On the playground, a teacher calls out to the class. She unravels a white rope with little interval loops for each child to grab hold of, a miniature chain gang taking the safest measures back to their school.
He intends to plead guilty, I say uncomfortably.
What will that do?
Get him sent directly to jail.
Delia looks up, stunned.
Why would you want that?
I wouldn't. I told him to take a chance on a trial, but it's not what he wants.
What about what I want?
If I show up in court in Arizona at Andrew's side, the judge will ask me how we plead, not Andrew. To say not guilty means subverting my client's request. It means Andrew could fire me and wind up with a lawyer who'd gladly enter a guilty plea because it's the path of least resistance. To say not guilty means a big, difficult trial in which Delia will serve as a material witness. As the only other person who was with Andrew at the time of the kidnapping, she will be courted by the prosecution as well as the defense. And in spite of the fact that she is my fiancée, I can be sent to jail for telling her any details about her father's case. It's a felony to consciously or unconsciously influence what a witness says in court. But is it a crime for her to influence what I say? I smooth my hand over her hair. Okay,
I promise. Not guilty.
Andrew, does it really matter why I did it? By now, you've already formed your own impression. You believe that an act committed a lifetime ago defines a man. Or you believe that a person's past has nothing to do with his future. You think I'm either a hero or a monster. Maybe knowing more about the circumstances will make you think differently about me. But it won't change what happened 28 years ago. There have been nightmares. Sometimes I picked up the phone and heard Elise's voice in the pause before the telemarketer's brain kicks in. Whenever I pass a police car, I sweat. I was thrown into a panic when one of the seniors submitted my name for election to the Wexton Town Council. Until I realized that the easiest place to take cover is in plain sight. No one ever looks twice.